You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 14th of September 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Chloe Potter, and Gillian DeBias.
Coming up on today's programme, as autumn arrives, we find novel cures to keep us in spiritual good health with publisher Jamie Bing. He's going to join us and talk through some toms.
And as the new artistic director of London's Royal Court Theatre kicks off her much-anticipated first season, we're joined by Matt Wolfe to discuss if her debut meets expectations.
And then...
we chew, what makes us glow.
We welcome back DJ and journalist Joe Muggs, who's bringing in some new and not yet released tracks.
We also have a bit of a film fix for you this week. Our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco gives us his verdict on Paolo Sorrentino's new film, where Rome takes center stage.
This is a modern and decadent Rome, a perfect portrait of the city nowadays. Among the characters, you have a cardinal tipped to become the next pope, unhappy socialites, among other fascinating characters.
And we'll be bringing you our usual wrap of cultural going-ons around the world this weekend.
So books, film, theatre and music, all sorts of treats for you on The Review here on Monocle 24.
Hello and a very warm welcome to this weekend's The Review. Chloe, so lovely to co-pilot the show with you this weekend.
Yes, we haven't presented together before, have we? It's lovely.
But
it's
I think
treat.
We're going to be great partners in this cultural review.
Yes. What have you been up to this week, Gillian?
Well, it's funny. I actually quite like fall when it starts to get really drizzly and cold and damp, and then I sort of hunker down and I go to see exhibitions and I don't feel guilty. And one of the nice things is I literally just stayed in one night and I played back the documentary, which was incredible. It was called Requiem for Detroit, and it was actually originally done in 2010, Julian Temple and Roger Grafe. And because of everything that's happened in Detroit, because it's gone bankrupt, BBC very cleverly has replayed it. And it's quite extraordinary because you have a cinema director who's taking this city, and of course cities are so cinematic in their own right, but this is with an epic story. And their use of archive footage is so inventive and ingenious. So I recommend anyone who can find it at a documentary film festival or playing back.
As the nights close in.
Exactly. What about you?
In contrast, I discovered a little bit of lingering summer in the basement of Somerset House here in London against the cold white walls of the basement there. There's an exhibition of Miles Aldridge's photography.
The fashion photographer.
Yes, the fashion photographer. Well, that's what, you know, he's so much more than just a fashion photographer. It's called I Only Want You to Love Me, which sums up, you know, his consistent subject of this perfect or seemingly perfect coiffed woman. They're amazing poppy colours, really saturated. They jump out at you from the white walls and you've got these kind of slightly sinister scenarios. So you've got the kind of Stepford wife looking perfectly coiffed and made up, immaculate, but looking quite vacant, sad, her coiffed hair right next to a lit gas stove, or the immaculately made up face beneath the plastic of a dry cleaning bag.
I'm dying to see it because I hear that not only is it these amazing colour photographs blown up, but they're like storyboards and contact sheets, and I always love that kind of behind the scenes.
I mean, it's great to see them in a decent size. You know, we're all used to seeing them on the pages of Vogue and other fashion magazines, but he really has a story to tell. They're quite filmic. You know, his inspiration, I learned at the exhibition, involves film directors, and I recommend it.
All right. Well, we are going to move on. We're going to talk theatre, we're going to talk music, and we're going to talk books next.
So we all appreciate the escapism that art can bring. When a play, book, film or exhibition takes you on an all-absorbing journey, there's nothing quite like it. And it's a theme that we're going to explore a little today. First up, the novel. And as Gillian was saying, as autumn arrives, what better treat is there than to curl up and get truly lost in something, including a good book. Today we're joined in the studio by Jamie Bing, publisher and managing director at Canongate Books.
Well, Jamie, we're going to talk about the pile of books you've brought in and about more about Canongate books. But first of all, there's one book that we have to talk about first because it kind of sums up, I think, everything we all love about reading. And it's The Novel Cure. I wonder if you can set this up for us.
The Novel Cure is a delightful kind of compendium which uses its kind of central conceit that books provide the best medicine and that books can cure really any kind of ailment, and particularly this book focuses on fiction and therefore novels. And what Susie and Ella have done, the two editors, is brilliantly select about 450 novels which they then prescribe for different ailments. But these ailments go from kind of a broken heart to being an only child, to having alopecia, to being apathetic. I love apathy. They recommend that you read James M. Cain's The Postman Almost Always Rings Twice. And for each of the ailments, sorry, for each of the books, in prescribing it for an ailment, they then write anywhere between 200 and 400 words. And these provide brilliant insights and I think kind of appreciations of the books. And whether you know the books or don't know the books, they provide a wonderful way of understanding what that book is. And it was Rachel Joyce, the novelist, who said, who wrote The Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, which I'm sure you know, she said, it's the sort of book you choose for a friend and end up wanting to keep. My advice would be to buy two.
And it is kind of like having a friend sitting there on the bookshelf, a friend with great literary knowledge, and you can turn to that friend and say, what do I need? Which novel should I dip into right now at this point in my life? I love the origin of this book too, Jamie, the way that, am I right in saying they actually had a series of consultations with people over years where they act as, they describe themselves as bibliotherapists, where they would have a consultation with someone and then, as you say, prescribe the right novel for their condition.
Well, that's exactly right. And it's interesting you talk about it being like having a kind of well-read friend there, because I think the friendship between Ella and Susie, which goes back kind of 20 years, is something that comes across very strongly in the book because they've been having conversations with one another for many, many years about books. And then it was a few years back that they started to kind of turn this into this idea of being bibliotherapists and the idea of actually prescribing novels to solve people's kind of ailments. So that's my little son, Nathaniel, who's just kind of singing in the background there. Ella and Susie, they do these kind of sessions. They were at Latitude recently, the festival, and they had an ambulance there and people could go in for these half-hour sessions where they'd talk to you about, you know, whatever, kind of literally in a kind of therapy-type way.
I mean, it talks of books as like drugs, and I just find this book an addiction in itself. I was reading it this morning and I could not put it down, partly because there's also a lot of humour in it. Mm. It's very clever and it has very jokes. I was writing down some of them, like, you know, one of them, there's, you know, and they kind of take it and they write it like a bit of a medical journal, and there's like control freak, comma, being or old age, comma, horror of. I mean, so it sort of almost looks like a very old fashioned doctor's journal for how to prescribe treatments. But then there are these gems and nuggets, and also why it's so funny, because it touches all those things that we're always obsessive about our books. Like, I'm very obsessive about loaning my books, and there's a whole page of advice for people whose libraries are depleted because they're obsessive loaners, and, you know, how to throw curses on people to get your books back.
Yeah. There's lots of lovely tips in the book, aren't there? In amongst the novels that are recommended.
Yeah, they have these reading ailments. If you're suffering from certain things, like stuck on sci-fi, which lots of people don't ever go into that genre because actually it does feel kind of slightly off-putting. And they're like, hold on, within it, think of it as speculative fiction rather than science fiction. And then you'll suddenly start opening it up to people like a Margaret Atwood or a Kurt Vonnegut or people who actually aren't really sci-fi writers per se. And unsure of your reading identity.
I love that one. Build a favourite shelf. Yeah. It's such a clever tip.
It's actually very, 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 very clever.
I just, for me as a publisher, to publish a book like this, which is really just a glorious celebration of what books can do and the incredible diversity of books that are out there, because books really do cover everything we've ever thought of or could think of. Books have kind of explored those and explored those in quite a deep and intense way. And I think this book does that, but as you say, with enormous wit. I think it's one of the greatest guides to books I've ever come across, and I think it's going to be a huge success. I think it deserves to be.
Before we go on to the other books you have, I just wanted to touch a little bit about just your publishing house, because this book for you just must be very much what's at the heart of everything you do for your love of books. But what, as a publisher, what do you specialize in? What do you look for?
Well, you know, we at Canongate, we really only ever publish books that we're passionate about, because for us, if we're not passionate about them, how could we ever expect anyone else to be interested in them? And we also do a certain type of publishing, which tends to be fiction and kind of voice-driven non-fiction, and then kind of some quirky reference things like The Novel Cure. We don't do kind
of... And you discovered The Life of Pi, is that right?
Well, I published Life of Pi. I didn't discover it, but I was involved in the publishing of it here in the UK. Mm. We published it at Canongate in 2002, and yeah, it was a tremendous success for us, and I think is a wonderful novel. So, we take a lot of care in what we publish. We don't publish that many books a year, but we try and make sure that everything we do care, we publish with enormous attention to detail. And
Jamie, you can see in the way some of the books you've brought in today are bound, actually, the whimsical way they're bound, and that you take a great deal of care. And I'm sure The A to Z is going to be on everyone's Christmas list, certainly mine. But moving on to some of the other books that you're recommending today, the next one's on the Man Booker Prize shortlist.
It
we
is.
We need new names.
It's not a book that I or we published at Canongate, but I would love us to have published it, because I think it's an extraordinary debut. It's by this woman called Noviolet Bulawayo, and it's called We Need New Names. And it has one of the most... I think kind of winning and charming, but also really captivating first person voices I've come across in a novel for many years. It's narrated by this young Zimbabwean girl called Darling, who's 10 when the book begins, and her view of the world was one that changed my view of the world. And I just think when a book can do that, it's doing something special. But it's also done with incredible wit and underlying kind of social and political power and intent. And I think it's a very subtle novel, but is also an intensely powerful book. And I think it's pretty hard not to fall in love with Darling.
Can you set the book up a little bit?
It's really kind of telling the story of what's happened in Zimbabwe in the last 20 years. And it's this young girl has kind of, and her family have lost many of the things that they had in previously. And so she's 10, living in a kind of shanty town, and she's kind of, it's really about her and a kind of close-knit, all her the kind of friends she lives on the street with. And but it's also, the background is kind of Zimbabwe in this kind of period of incredible upheaval as things are changing, and Mugabe is doing all sorts of things to the country, which are kind of causing all sorts of kind of social problems. But in the course of the novel, she leaves Zimbabwe and she's in America, so it then becomes a very interesting immigrant story. So I think it's got a very broad scope, despite being told through this incredible first-person voice.
A first-person voice that sort of childlike naivety that allows you to explore traumatizing events such as those that have happened in Zimbabwe with a humour and
a
joyful... That voice is very joyful, that first-person voice. How much of it is autobiographical?
I don't know, because I don't know Noviolet. So my relationship with the book is simply as a reader of the text. So I know that she did spend, I'm pretty sure, but I think she is from Zimbabwe originally, but I think she's been in the States for, I know she teaches now, she has a kind of Stegner Fellowship and teaches, I think, at Stanford in San Francisco. So, and I think America's been has figured large in her adult life. On one level, I don't really care. And I think it's sometimes interesting where a book comes from and how close, you know, certain things in the book could be to experiences the authors have. But ultimately, I don't care. It's just whether it works on the page for me. And this book seriously worked on the page. I thought it was a really arresting, heartbreaking book, but also, as you said,
heartbreaking is exactly the word I would
but
use.
With but with humour in it too, and that's, as you say, achieved through this voice. And I think it becomes, the humour drops as the book goes on, as she becomes older and kind of more experienced and a sense sadder, and you know, that a lot of that joy, which is impossible to repress really in a child, kind of does get repressed through the course of the book. I think it's a fantastic novel.
I picked it up this morning and just reading some of the pages, there's just such, you know, magic in almost the verse of what she writes. And then I went to read some of the reviews, and there were a few of them sort of criticizing it for kind of stereotyping poverty in Africa and poverty porn. And I just thought, isn't that kind of political correctness gone wrong? Because shouldn't novels, you know, maybe run with stereotypes and touch on things? Like, I thought that was sort of perhaps just, you know, very sort of something worth bringing up and talking about, but, you know, for a novel, maybe perhaps a harsh criticism.
I certainly think so. I think this is a book of real kind of moral complexity and political power and kind of social consciousness. So I would absolutely defy that. That's what it's doing. It's kind of poverty porn. It's like, it's just telling it like it is in a country.
Exactly.
And if that's anyway.
Jamie, another of the books that you recommended, very different, a funny look at the human species, really, and their idiosyncrasies. It's a cliched idea, isn't it? Tell us about it.
Yeah, it's the device of...
All right, so this is The Humans from Matt Haig.
Matt is a terrific writer that we've been publishing now for... just a few years. We published his previous novel called The Radleys, which was about a family of abstaining vampires, which is extremely funny and smart too. But in his new novel, I think it's the best thing he's written. And I love what Jeanette Winston said about it. She said, Matt Haig uses words like a tin opener. We are the tin. And I think what he does in this book is use this conceit of having an alien who comes down to Earth to kind of observe the human race in all its eccentricities and oddities I won't tell you the entire plot story, but ultimately this alien is inhabiting the body of this rather kind of socially awkward and not particularly good father or husband, this maths professor in Cambridge called Andrew Martin, and who's managed to solve Riemann's theorem, the consequences of which will be catastrophic to the universe if it becomes more widely known, which is why this alien's come down, killed the mathematician, inhabited his body, and then what precedes is this alien slowly becoming human. But by being kind of surrounded by humans and starting to understand what makes humans tick. But it's a book of brilliant kind of, I think, a kind of a social kind of comedy of errors, which I just think is delightful, but actually has some really quite profound things to say about what does it mean to be human.
Yes, I love the fact that the alien is inside the body of this professor, and yet the son and wife of this professor don't even notice.
It seems very far-fetched, and I think, is it slapstick or does it work?
Well, I think it works. Kind of a lot of things are, you know, Life of Pi is very far-fetched. Kind of the idea that a boy could spend 230 days on board a lifeboat with a Bengal tiger is absurd. Or you know, one of my favourite books of recent years is Marcus Zusak's The Book Thief, you know, narrated by death. That's kind of absurd on one level. And I would argue that our book on the Booker shortlist this year, Ruth Ozeki's A Tale for the Time Being, is it plausible that this diary by this Japanese teenage girl has washed up on the shores of Desolation Sound in British Columbia? I think what Matt does is make you just want to go with the story because it's done with such charm. And I think his observations are brilliant on the way humans, the oddness of human behavior. And actually, even just the clothes that we wear now, or just the way that we kind of interact with one another. And he's very good in that, in the way that in Nick Rogue's movie, The Man Who Fell to Earth, you've got those same really, I think, insightful observations about humans.
Jamie, as ever, really good to talk to you. Jamie Bing from Canongate Books. Thank you so much for joining us on The Review this week.
Pleasure to be on. Thanks for having me.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock. The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
I don't even know what to think about that.
Take the global pulse.
I was at a Bunga Bunga party the other day.
And?
I wasn't at all. I just wanted to start a show like that. We're at 187 shows down. How's your week been?
I'm feeling 187, actually.
And occasionally take things down a notch, too.
I had a pair of plum suede loafers with gold snaffles. The guy stopped his car and leant out of the window and said it was people like me who were bringing this country to its knees.
To end the week with the best chat.
We know that he had them and we know that he used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that.
Some great music.
Do you know, I never thought that I might need to have a question about death metal, but I'm warming up.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
I went to Afghanistan under the Taliban when I was 26 years old, and I sort of just saved my money and went to photograph women living under the Taliban. And now I realize, wow, that was pretty dangerous.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
Affair at the end is on the one side a market platform, but I think especially here in Asia and in Southeast Asia, it should also be a place of an exchange, of a get-together.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24, brought to you in association with Rolex.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Chloe Potter, and Gillian DeBias.
Time now to cross to Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief and our very own culture doctor, Nelly Gotcheva, to hear some cultural tonics from around the world she prescribes for us this weekend.
This weekend, San Francisco's Meridian Gallery welcomes American Beauty, the opulent pre-depression architecture of Detroit. Canadian photographer Philip Germain captures the remains of the city's glory days of the early 20th century with his large format photos of Detroit's historical architecture and buildings. The exhibition is on until the 20th of October. For more information, go to meridiangallery.com. In London, the Institute of Contemporary Art has organized the ambitious show entitled Journey Through London Subculture, from the 1980s to now. Housed in the old Selfridges Hotel, the project is a journey back to London's post-punk era, making connections between London's creative past and present through diverse works of art, fashion, craft and design. On show are videos, installations and billboard-sized images. The exhibition is on until the 20th of October. For more details, go to ica.org.uk. Artify Gallery in Hong Kong displays the works of Laura Lee Nogueira, a Hong Kong-based artist who uses local social issues and current affairs as guiding subjects in her works. Her latest series, Paper Affairs, which uses traditional Chinese techniques of paper cutting, provides a quirky look at everyday issues affecting Hong Kong. Paper Affairs by Laura Lee Nogueira is on until the 17th of October. Istanbul's Sakip Sabanci Museum welcomes the first exhibition of Bombay-born sculptor Anish Kapoor in Turkey. On show are Kapoor's never-previously-seen marble sculptures and some artifacts that are inspired by Cappadocia and Istanbul's Roman and Ottoman architecture. The exhibition is on until the 5th of January. Finally, this weekend we'll be listening to the Icelandic electronic band Moom and their album Smile Wound. And now let's hear them with Tooth Wheels. For Monocle in Toronto, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
That was Moom with Tooth Wheels, ending that report there by Nelly Gotcheva.
It's time now for our weekly music review, and today we're delighted to welcome back DJ and journalist Jo Muggs into the studio.
Specialising in everything from club culture to the more arcane and bass-heavy end of the dance music spectrum, Jo writes regularly for The Wire, Mix Mag and The Arts Desk, and he's here to give us his pick of some new releases. Jo, welcome back to the review.
Hi, lovely to be here again.
So are you back from a summer of heady festivals?
I wish I could say I was. with a young baby in tow, it's quite difficult. But we did do Camp Bestival this year.
Oh, well done.
So the full family experience.
So where have you been searching out your new music and new acts? Where do you go to discover new things that excite you?
I've been going to Algo Raves recently.
What?
That is impressive with a three-year-old son, still.
Not with the child, but I'm off to one tonight. And these are computer coders, possibly the geekiest events of all time, people who write the code to create the sounds live. There's no pre-existing synthesizers. They actually type the code and then the sounds come out of the computer. It's kind of arcane.
Adrenaline. That must make the adrenaline pump.
Strangely, it does. Yes, you think of it as, you think of someone, you know, the cliche is of someone checking their emails on stage and it's the antithesis of rock and roll posing. But actually, you know, the visceral sounds that they make combined with this knowing that they're doing everything by the seat of their pants gets quite a buzz going.
Okay. I guess like the improvisation of jazz or something. You just never know what to expect.
Yes, very much.
That's a lovely idea. That's a lovely parallel, Gillian. So we should have a listen to some of the tracks that you've brought for us to hear.
No Algo Rave music.
Next time.
Let's kick off with something by ARP, Judy Nylon. Tell us a bit about that first and then we'll have a listen.
This is actually the one I know the least about and the sort of newest discovery to me. But this guy, it seems, has been kicking around the more high class downtown bits of New York for the last decade or so. His name's Alexis Georgopoulos. And this is just an incredibly New York record. It's full of Velvet Underground and Strokes and Lou Reed and so on.
Let's have a listen.
Yes.
So that's Judy Nylon by ARP there. Jo, for me, it's a kind of lingering sense of summer in that track. You know, you're at a festival, you hear it wafting across the fields, but it doesn't, for me, I'm not sure it goes anywhere.
I don't think it does. It's just one of those. It's a mood conjuring track. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, what I really love about it is how unashamedly retro it is, and you know, there's stacks of Roxy music in there as well as the Velvet Underground.
But that's
why
you said that sounded very New York to you, and I was thinking Blur and Britpop a little bit. Is that just me?
I guess that's possible. I mean, it's the cultural exchange is constant. I mean, you know, the Blur certainly would have had their antecedents in, well, all UK indie. It owes a debt to the Velvet Underground, there's no doubt about that. But there's just so much anxiety about being retro, and there's always this balance of whether people carry it off or not. And I just think this guy has a love of sound. I love, you know, as you hear each new layer of guitar coming on, the narrative is not necessarily in chord structures or song structures. It's just in this kind of layering of sound. And I like that in the same way as I like electronic music.
And when would you listen to that track, Jo, do you think?
When would I listen to that track? I think I would actually be most likely to put that track on when I'm DJing in a pub. I think it's just a really nice... you say summer, I actually hear autumn evenings in the pub,
right,
with a glass of wine.
Why not? Why not? So let's go to the next track you've brought in. I really like this, the naivety, the sort of childlike quality of this. It's a band called Sap, and this is their track, What Makes Us Glow. Should we have a listen first?
Let's.
We chew, what makes us glow? A summer tea.
So that's What Makes Us Glow by Sap. Why did you choose that one, Joe?
This is a band I've liked for a long time. They've been around, again, for the best part of a decade, but I have followed their music. They're a duo, and I just like, A, the absolute individuality. I mean, they have this sound that is unmistakably them, and that's a really reassuring thing in this time when, you know, people fear that the economic collapse of the music industry causes conformity and stuff, that a band like this can have a career. And they've, you know, they've... Though they're relatively obscure, they found their place and they've kind of wormed their way around the industry. They wrote the theme tune to Grey's Anatomy, of all things.
Ah, clever them.
I was listening to it and thinking, you know, there's a lovely sound and it's almost like a homemade sound. And then I started reading up on them and I was reading that they were credited as being the creators of Toytronics, an evolution of... late 90s music made with toys and toys instruments. Is that true? Is there a genre like that?
it's one of those ad hoc genres that someone's clearly made up or they made up. But when they first came about, when I was first aware of them around the sort of turn of the millennium, there were a little slew of bands who were using toys in their or these kind of click-clop domestic sounds and small sounds. Tung are another one who I can't remember whether I think I might have played one of their tracks last time I was in, but Coco Rosie again, and it was associated with the Folktronica movement at the time, and it was all about domesticity and smallness, and I guess it's what's actually led us to some of the slightly cutesy, kitschy craft movements that are now kind of taking over the mainstream now. A lot of this was an antecedent of that.
I think it's lovely. You can really hear the layers of all the different instruments, almost like a crowd of people, and one of them's picked up some shells and you can kind of hear them chinking next to each other.
It sounds naive.
Lovely. You can deconstruct it.
But I think that naivety is lovely and it's nice.
It does, but it's also incredibly meticulous and sophisticated. I mean, you couldn't get away with that. You could do it in a lo-fi way, but actually it's beautifully put together and produced. By all accounts, they're quite... a fiery pair of people, quite out there, and have been, you know, around the houses and had quite a dramatic backstory. And apparently this is their kind of finding peace album in some ways.
I have to say, just a small note about the some of the artwork that they have on their albums. Another of their singles, Everything Belongs to the Sun. Mm-hmm. Gorgeous artwork of kind of where the wild things are type creatures carrying suns. And it sort of evokes that really kind of whimsical feel that I think.
And
they
it's
have.
Nice that they invest in the artwork, because now when people are downloading so much, often, you know, the cover and the artwork, you know, is forgotten about. And it's great that they're, you know, really
absolutely. But I will
that.
Always fly the flag for the childish and naive as having, you know, hidden power. Maurice Sendak, perfect example. You know, there's a reason that those works of his last. It's that William Blake innocence and experience thing.
Absolutely. The third track is Rain by Rafferty. Tell us a little bit about Rafferty first, Joe.
This is one guy, Benjamin Stefaneski, I believe. Now, I'm afraid I've forgotten where he's from. I believe he's a Midlander, but now resident in London. And he started doing instrumental music very much in what was known as post-dubstep, using the kind of club sounds of dubstep, but breaking away from the rhythmic constraints of it. And more he's brought in his own vocals. He's a... you know, clearly hyper-talented multi-instrumentalist. And this latest album that he's done on Ninja Tune, of which this is the new single, is a fully fledged singer-songwriter album. And, you know, what really puzzles me about this is that there is no genre name for this. I mean, I know that we journalists are derided for making up genres, but somehow this kind of sound is now so entrenched. When you think of James Blake and what Tom York does in his solo stuff and Hot Chip and Metronomy and stuff, you know, I've always used this word Indietronica as shorthand, never caught on, you know.
Joe, it's funny you should mention Hot Chip, because that is immediately what I thought of when I heard this track. Let's listen to it.
That was Rafferty and Rain, the wonderful track chosen? I mean, the kind of track I would love to listen to going on a long train ride. I mean, a great track for your imagination.
Very much so. I mean, this whole album is one to really sink into, and it's the traveling music is a great way of describing it, or you know, driving at night.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
in the rain.
Absolutely.
And actually, we must hear a little clip from the final track that you chose, because this is the one that reminded me of Hot Chip. I've realised I've got confused. And I want people to hear that deliberate offbeat, just a few seconds of it. And then unfortunately, that's all we've got time for. Okay, so that was Paper Tiger with Drift, and we recommend it. People should listen to the whole thing. We didn't have time, but it's definitely that same school that you were talking about.
Yeah, I mean, oddly, they come from a jazz funk kind of background.
Oh,
they're this 11-piece band from Wolverhampton, but they do come from this increasing thing. And again, there's no name for it, but live electronic music. It's far, far easier for people to trigger electronic sounds live. I saw Jessie Ware live this week, and her album is very electronic and huge in its scope. But her and this very small band were actually performing it live, no backing tracks, because they all had samplers, sample trigger pads and so on. So they were able to, you know, the technology is small enough and portable enough for bands to really be able to do this live offbeat thing.
We'll have a listen, but for now we have to leave it. Joe Muggs, thank you so much for joining us again on The Review.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
So this week, instead of our usual city look ahead, we've decided to take front row seats at Paolo Sorrentino's new film, The Great Beauty. It was one of the successes in Cannes this year, and it's just been released here in the UK and will be rolled out internationally this autumn.
We sent Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco to a screening of this modern-day La Dolce Vita, and here now is his review.
I am a fan of exuberant opening sequences in films, and Italian films do it very well. The Great Beauty, or as they say in Italian, La Grande Bellezza, has a fantastic one. First, you see a group of Japanese tourists walking around the touristic spots of Rome. And suddenly, you're immersed in a party of over 50s dancing to the techno beat of classic Italian singer Raffaella Carrà and French DJ Bob Sinclair, with a new version of her classic Far l'amore. The camera is frenetic, from strippers to Berlusconi lookalikes. It all seems a bit like a bunga bunga party. And then we're presented to Giuseppe Gamberdella, a charming bon vivant and journalist living in Rome, who is celebrating his 65th birthday at the party. Giap is played fantastically by Tony Servillo, who has been working with Paolo Sorrentino since the director's first film. The film is a celebration of Rome. In some ways, it seems to me like an updated version of Fellini's classic La Dolce Vita.
Marcello, come here! Hurry up!
Sì, Silvia. Vengo anch'io. Vengo anch'io.
But this is a modern and decadent Rome. A perfect portrait of the city nowadays. Among the characters, you have a cardinal tipped to become the next pope, unhappy socialites, among other fascinating characters. The scenes are also striking, like when Jep visits a Botox party, where even nuns pay for the magical substance. La Grande Bellezza is decadent, joyful, and yes, overly long, but it can afford to be. Its excessiveness needs more than the usual 100-minute length. For Monocle, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Thank you very much for that, Fernando. The Great Beauty will be rolled out in cinemas around the world, kicking off with the UK this month, and we highly recommend you catch a screening.
You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be back with theatre critic Mac Wolfe after this short break. Don't go away.
The perfect way to start the day on the East Coast or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe, The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
Welcome back. It's Saturday. You're listening to The Review with me, Gillian Tobias, and Chloe Potter.
It's time to turn to theatre now. And we're joined in the studio by critic for the International Herald Tribune and Monocle regular Matt Wolfe. Matt's had a jet set time of late, which means we'll be getting the lowdown on New York's Broadway in a moment. But first, we're going to discuss the much anticipated first play of the season at London's Royal Court Theatre.
Now, the Royal Court is a place famed for its support of new writing, and it has a new leader at its helm. Vicky Featherstone has enjoyed fantastic success as the founding director of the National Theatre of Scotland, where everything she touched turned to gold. So will the magic continue now she's in residence in London's Sloane Square?
Matt, the very first play that Featherstone chose, The Ritual Slaughter of George Matromas, is actually written by the man who co-wrote hit musical Matilda. Now, it is a moral tale, just like Matilda, but it's pretty safe to say that fans of the musical are likely to be disappointed if they go to this play expecting something similar.
Yeah. To put it mildly, of course, the thing about Matilda is that, for which Dennis Kelly, by the way, won a Tony Award on Broadway last June, is that he was hired to be part of a very deft creative team, and he did very well with it. But when he was hired, a lot of people said, now that's very strange that Dennis Kelly is being asked to write an ostensibly family-friendly musical, because his theatrical landscape, as this play proves, is determinedly dark. This play is really his chosen terrain, and Matilda is kind of the sort of divertissement, although Matilda has a darkness to it as well. What's interesting comparing the two is that in Matilda you have this sort of pint-sized little girl, the Matilda of the title role, who discovers these extraordinary powers which she uses to sort of put her life right. Whereas in The Ritual Slaughter, you have a central character, George Nostromos, who also is a sort of Uberman in a way and has extraordinary capabilities, which he does to make the world a terrible place.
Mm. This is a very ambitious play. Chloe and I went the other evening, and I've never before gone to a theatre where the person taking your tickets and showing you to your seats warns you that it's an hour and a half, then there's an intermission, another an hour and a half. They're warning you about the length. It's a very heavy play. Does it work?
I thought it was fascinating. It's been interesting looking at the reviews for it in the British press. They've been either 4 stars, people really went for it, or 2 stars, they didn't like it at all. And in a way, that doesn't surprise me. I don't think it's a play you could be on the fence about. It's, I think, important to note that this isn't its world premiere. Its world premiere was in Germany. And I think that is not insignificant, because it seems to me to belong to a very determined tradition of German, in-your-face, nihilistic, life sucks drama. And there is actually a line...
Sucking the life out of you drama.
Well, yeah. There's a line somewhere in the second act where a character remarks, nothing actually matters. And I think that in a way, it's, if this doesn't sound paradoxical, it's a sort of celebration of nihilism and then a critique of it as well. The structure of it is very interesting. The first sort of 40 minutes consists of the 7 members of the cast filing on stage, sitting in chairs, narrating the life of the title character. Now, you know, the
in a very lengthy way, we should point out.
I mean, interesting.
Just sat in chairs.
But because what's said is kind of extraordinary, and, you know, this is not kind of just your ordinary nice guy playing in a playground. This is a guy who is defined early on by venality in basically every walk of life. But, you know, we're told in drama you should show, don't tell. And so what this does from the very beginning is tell, not show. But the telling of it is very, very good, I thought the actors were extremely deft at sort of passing the tale amongst themselves.
That was one of my favorite parts.
Me too.
The whole
like
thing.
A narrative baton. Okay, I'm throwing the ball to you. Yep. I'm throwing the ball to you.
Almost like ping pong game.
Yeah.
And the use of humor and just little gestures in the chair, little bits of action, which really created a sense of place.
Exactly, Claire. And I think it's important to point out, although this is a very dark and in a way fatalistic play, it is shot through with humor throughout, albeit a kind of, you know, black comedy. But in a way, I was less satisfied with the play, oddly, when it started to dramatize scenes from his life, because there didn't seem to be enough of them, even though it's a 3-hour play, to give me a sense that I was on the inside of this character looking out. Mm. And I really wanted to know, in terms of his dynamics with his brother, his girlfriend, his business colleagues, how did this monster, we're watching the birth of a monster, how did this monster get created and then presumably suffer a comeuppance at the end?
That's the thing, isn't it? It's quite, well, it's a very traditional tale of morality. It's that idea of making a pact with the devil. It will be your undoing. It might be great on the way, on the journey, and then it'll be your undoing. We've actually got a clip which from the sort of turning point of the play. Let's listen to that.
They're rich and powerful and they have everything because they'll do anything. The rest of the world will always be meat to them. Cattle, animals to be herded and sometimes hunted. We're a secret society. We don't have handshakes, we don't have meetings, we don't wear silly costumes on full moons, but we exist and we know each other. And when we see each other, we smile. And inside we say to each other, look at those idiots. Look at these food. Why are they so stupid? Why do they not just take what they want like we do?
Now, in many ways, because it is that familiar tale that we all know, there are no surprises in the play beyond a certain point.
Yes, and I think in a way that clip illustrates beautifully probably the fundamental flaw with the play, in my view, which is that it's almost as if the thesis came first and the play came second, i.e. Dennis Kelly wants to tell us something about the fact that we inhabit a hardscrabble world, it's tough out there, and you either go with that and you make it work for you, or basically you lose. Mm. And they keep posing during the play this rhetorical question, is it goodness or cowardice, goodness or cowardice? And the answer within the play seems to be that they're the same. Goodness equals cowardice. So the only way around that is to become as horrific as possible. I must say, though, I really admire Vicki Featherston for doing this, because it's in an absolute tradition of royal court writing. It's confrontational. It's aggressive. It's sexually, politically quite candid. It's got lots of violence, some implicit more than explicit. It doesn't play by the rules. And that's good. That's what the royal court is there for.
I mean, I absolutely adore the Royal Court Theatre because it takes risks with writing. I like the space of it. I like the writing. And I did find myself fluctuating when I was watching this production, because part of me really was so drawn into the rhythm of the words and the writing. And I just thought, if there would have been a good editor to just really say, that works, that doesn't, that works, I think they could have had something exceptional on their hands.
Yes, in a funny way, even though it's 3 hours long, it doesn't seem long enough in a sense to tell the tale it wants to tell, which is why a lot of the narrative seems very telescoped. I do want to give a shout out though to Tom Brooke in the title role, who I thought was amazing, amazing.
I'm sure we'll all agree on
and
that.
And by
it was
the
captivating.
End, we were all there at the same night, as it turns out, and at the end, before he stood to take his bow, he was sort of wiping a tear away, and I thought, this must ask so much of him. He looked absolutely hollowed out by the experience.
He's quite caricatured in a way, in the way that he performs.
Well, partly because of his looks. I was reading a review and they described him as an escapee from a Bruegel painting.
Yes.
He has an amazing face.
He reminded me a little of Jim Broadbent.
Yes.
You know, that kind of extreme facial expression. And but I thought he was fantastic. And at that very beginning scene that we talked about, where they're narrating his childhood, when he spoke, it was as though there was a spotlight on him. And all you could see on
the stage was
him.
And you didn't know that was before you knew he was going to be the
Yeah, absolutely. And that was amazing, because there wasn't. And, you know,
exactly.
He just draws your attention. He was captivating. And I also, I think it's worth mentioning the female lead, Pippa Hayward.
The younger one, Cato Flynn.
She was great.
Actually, I thought the entire cast was good. And Alan Williams, who's one of the older company members, who has a wonderful bit, and this is so Royal Court, where he starts insulting the audience, and then of course he starts apologizing.
I'm so sorry.
And I thought, oh, that's so great. It's the Royal Court tweaking itself.
Yeah, there were moments of real British humour, actually. You know, in Cato Flynn's part, and also there apologising to the audience. It was incredible. And the sort of comments about the references to bad marital sex and all of those things that you get in British.
But I doffed my cap to Vicky for this, and I think it was full on that night. There were lots of young people. I didn't see anyone bored. People didn't leave, as far as I could tell, maybe a few. But, you know, that's what the theatre should do. It should shake things up.
What do you think will happen to this play? Where will it go?
Oh, I mean, you know, it's not there to be commercial. It might get done in lots of anti-capitalist bastions around the world. So I don't know.
That's the thing, isn't it? It is responding to that sense that is dominating the media and has, and we're all a bit bored of it, that sense that there's these privileged fat cats who are taking advantage of the rest of us. I was a little bit disappointed that that was the theme for Vicky Featherstone's first play, because I felt like it's been done to death.
Well, actually, it's really interesting you say that. I agree, not least because, although this wasn't Vicky's regime, you see, this is a new regime, but the Royal Court did 3 plays in the last year that affected variations on this theme, including a 3-hour American play called The Low Road by Bruce Norris, which was a totally different play in substance, but the theme of it was exactly the same. So you think, I mean, I know the Royal Court is anti-bourgeois, but there must be another way of expressing it. Mm-hmm. However, I do think for anyone who wants to go on an extraordinary ride and see an amazing performance, it's worth seeing. Mm-hmm.
The Royal Court is quite exceptional. It's not just the plays it puts on in its main theatre, but it has a kind of philosophy to nurture new writings. They have a whole programme of events. What else are they doing this season?
Well, just to speak generally about the court, it's no exaggeration to say that I think it's the most important theatre in London. What else are they doing? They have a season of Chilean work. You want to bone up on your Chilean theatre? Here's your chance. They're doing more American work. They're doing Beckett. Whatever you want is at the Royal Court. It is a crucial destination for London playgoing.
Matt, we promised in the introduction that we were going to touch on your recent jet set trip to New York.
Yes.
And we've run out of time.
Oh, no.
You're going to have to come back.
We'll just have to talk about Orlando Bloom another time.
Yeah, and Orlando Bloom and a play about chess.
Yes, the machine, which is what you saw.
But we promise we'll have you back.
Okay, thank you very much.
We just had to come along.
Yeah,
we had too much to talk about in reference to Vicky Featherstone. But I think the upshot is do go and see it.
Give it a whirl.
Give it a whirl. Follow the Royal Court.
That brings us to the end of our Saturday review. Our show today was produced by Annabel Bly, Katie Bilboa, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Thanks also to researcher Henrietta Landells and our studio manager Christopher Grimes.
We're handing back over to Georgina with the weekend edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget to tune into the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air Sunday at midday London time with Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound here at Midori House and Tom Edwards in Frankfurt.
You've been listening to The Review. Goodbye from me, Chloe Potter.
And goodbye from me, Gillian DeBias.
Bye-bye.